Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to Taxation is Theft. And today I've got with me Arvind Vohra, who you may know. He is the former Libertarian vice chair. He is running for U.S. Senate in Maryland, and he has also announced that he's running for President of the United States of America in 2020. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here, excited to talk about what I plan to do as president to massively downsize the state.
Awesome. That's music to my ears.
Good. I thought it might be. I wasn't sure, but I thought it might be.
Yeah, especially if taxes get downsized with it. So let's talk. I'm assuming your platform for both Senate and president is pretty much going to be the same.
The goals are going to be the same, but the method is different, right?
Right.
So there are things that you can do as president that can massively and immediately downsize the state. Simple examples. If I'm elected, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to just take on the role of pardoner in chief. I'm not going to wait for Congress to end the drug war. I'm just going to end it single-handedly by pardoning everyone in jail for a nonviolent drug offense. Trafficking, selling, buying, being a kingpin. I've already pledged that Edward Snowden and Ross Ulbricht are going to be first on the list, but it's also going to be everyone else who's there for some kind of nonsense crime, cryptocurrency, possessing a gun that you never hurt anybody with, all that kind of nonsense. And it's going to be an ongoing thing. If somebody else gets arrested for having marijuana or cocaine or selling, I don't care what, the second they're arrested, I'm going to pardon them 5 seconds later. As soon as I know about it, I'm pardoning them. And so as president, I will single-handedly end the war on drugs. I will single-handedly get rid of all the rules on cryptocurrency. I will single-handedly get rid of a lot of the rules that get in the way of our natural right to defend ourselves that's expressed by the Second Amendment of the Constitution. And so there is a difference in there. If I'm elected to Senate, obviously that has to go through the process of proposing a bill. And if I'm elected Senate, I absolutely will be proposing bills to do just that.
Absolutely. That's awesome. And that's something we don't hear too much, because you know there are a lot of people who are, especially libertarians, we get angry whenever a president pardons themselves or pardons like these people who were involved in their scandals. Yep. And then we're also, you know, we hear about how much libertarians hate executive orders and how they're abused and everything, but at the same time it's like, okay, well, if we can use those in our favor, why not?
Yeah. And I have no problem with executive orders. I mean, to me, it's just like a gun. A gun is fine. Using a gun for an immoral purpose is not fine. It's not okay to use a gun to shoot up a school. It is absolutely okay to use a gun to protect yourself. I don't think it's okay to use an executive order to have a permanent ongoing 17-year war. I don't think it's okay to use an executive order to grow government. But I absolutely do believe that it's okay to use an executive order to shrink government. And I will be doing that literally constantly in every way possible, in some of the ways that I've talked about, in some ways that I'll probably need a few legal advisors to help me really think about clever ways to just massively have 90% plus reductions in government.
Nice. And also, you know, I can say it sounds like the ways you're planning on using executive orders are also more legal than past presidents.
I mean, and that's how the Constitution was written. It's actually supposed to be easier for the government to not do something, stop the government from doing something than to do something. But everything's been turned so sideways and upside down and backwards that we've gotten away from that. By the time that I'm done with that first day and most federal employees have been laid off, most federal agencies have maybe not been legally shut down, but functionally shut down. By the time that most of the prisoners are out of prison, by the time that most of the troops have come home, by the time we've shut down these foreign military bases and sold off all these assets, things are going to be pretty different, a lot better. There's going to be more room for innovation, more skilled labor, more growth, massive growth in the economy. I mean, that's what we're talking about with this.
Right. And I think that's, everybody's always worried about jobs, and especially government employees, when you come in and say, we're going to get rid of this department, that department. Mm-hmm. They're all worried about their jobs. But I think you made a really good point. that, you know, the jobs are like, the, like, there will be new jobs, there will be better jobs, there will be different jobs, jobs that pay more. It's and especially if I, you know, I'm sure you're planning on getting some of the regulatory restrictions out of the way of businesses. So yeah, that's definitely like a good thing to have in mind for, you know, the people that are, I know, already going to jump out and say, but my job.
And that's true. I mean, if you work for the government right now, if you're a government contractor right now, if I'm elected, you're going to be fired. That's a fact. That's how it's going to be. But there's also going to be so many exciting new jobs, massive growth in industry. And one of the things that I talked about just earlier today, actually, was the creation of an entirely new educational sector, not by government action, but by stopping government abuse. Specifically, I'm talking about higher education. Today, the government has so many regulations that higher education startups are impossible. And what this does, it leaves old, defunct, now mostly socialist, you know, quote, higher education institutions, where the primary higher education that you get is education in socialism and alcoholism, it leaves them somehow at the top. They should have lost decades ago. The Ivy League, based on its current level of incompetence, should not be, those should not be dominant companies. They should be has-beens, but they're being protected. I'm going to get rid of those regulations. I'm going to make it so easy for new companies to start up. And what we will see is a growth in the educational sector on par with, or more likely bigger than, the growth that happened in the tech sector in the 1990s. We're talking about massive, huge, innovative growth, more jobs, more opportunities, lower cost options, student debt, parents, you know, saving up their entire lives will no longer be necessary. Just like you no longer go into debt to buy a computer, in under this type of educational growth, you won't have any reason to go into debt to buy an education.
And so you actually have like, correct me if I'm wrong, you have like your own business is in education. So, you know,
I do. So
tell me something about that.
It's, I mean, working in free market education is just the most exciting part of the modern economy. I mean, you get to wake up and innovate and try out new amazing ideas. And some of the ideas don't go anywhere, but some of the ideas lead to a whole new way of thinking. It's constant. Every day is different. Every day is exciting. But the problem is today, only a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of educators get to do that. You know why? Because 99% of kids are stuck in basically being forced to pay for not very good government education. Now imagine if those kids could spend their money, and I don't mean through vouchers, I mean their own money, or their parents' own, could spend their own money on whatever education they wanted. Now all of a sudden, there's opportunities for curriculum designers, educational toy makers, teachers, tutors, all these people, because there's so many more clients who are looking for that. I wish every teacher in America could do, you know, something, maybe not exactly the same as what I do, but something where it's creative and innovative and exciting, not stifling and bureaucratic and just silly and pointless. I wish everybody could have that. And by getting government out of education entirely, by abolishing government schools, by ending the Department of Education, that's what we can have in America.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And I mean, I can say I spent most of my time in public school, and most of the stuff that I use in the real world today in my job is stuff that I learned outside of the school, because it was, you know, there it was. And I'm not going to say I didn't learn anything useful, but, you know, it's most of the stuff that you learn is just memorizing stuff that you're never going to use. A lot of it was about government, and I was completely uninterested back then, so I didn't remember any of it until afterwards, when I learned, you know, when it was actually kind of relevant to my life. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. And, you know, I know that you've got your, you know, you have your actual experience with that. It's not like you're just coming along and saying, you know, let's get rid of this and see what happens. You actually have some experience with that. So that's actually really awesome to know.
The other thing that people forget is, you know, we're not just a laboring force. The modern economy demands that we're all innovators. And today we have literally millions of innovators who are not allowed to innovate. Every day there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of great teachers and other folk who would be innovating, who are innovating in their minds, but they're not allowed to actually try out their innovations. They're stuck. Every day, thousands of great ideas are just being flushed down the toilet of government incompetence. Imagine if all of those great ideas are things that people could try out. And I know they're not going to all work. Some ideas work, some don't. That's the nature of innovation. But imagine that, the growth in innovation. Imagine if education in America was as innovative as, or more innovative than, technology. That's what we could have. We're almost there. We just need to have the courage to say, you have failed, to the government. To say to the government, this has failed. This isn't working anymore. Let's end government schools entirely. Let's get government out of education. Let's abolish the Federal Department of Education. And let's have free market, real free market education.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sign me up.
Excellent.
So let's see. I'm trying to see some of the other things that you have on your platform. We kind of talked about military a little bit, but let's go a little bit deeper into that.
Sure.
I know there's especially a lot of my viewers are pretty sick of all of the endless wars that are going on. Mm-hmm. We're using military to help corporations extract and protect resources in nations that they're not even from. They're protecting them to steal resources. And then somehow we have this epidemic in our country of nationalism and supporting the troops and all this other stuff, which is a really hard barrier to get over, because it's meaningless. There's even a lot of military who wakes up and says, hey, we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. But then there's also a lot of military where they've just been in there for generations. So it's almost like it doesn't matter what they're doing. They believe they're doing what's right.
And we see that. I mean, that's actually not that uncommon in American culture, in any culture. Today, I've heard people talk about the problems of generational welfare, which I agree with. I do think generational welfare is wrong. And I've heard the same person minutes later talk about how they, their parents, their kids, their grandparents, and their grandkids all went to government schools. I mean, that is generational welfare, but they haven't seen it as generational welfare. That's how deeply they have the blinders on. They've been told that, well, generational welfare is okay if it's for the middle class, just not for the poor. And in the same way, many people who've been in military families for many generations, they have been taught that whatever the military does is right, even though it's not. I mean, one of the issues that people worry about today is they worry that if we don't have the U.S. military in all these oil-producing areas, we just won't have oil. And that's nonsense. Today, people try to smuggle oil from ISIS-controlled areas to the U.S. Today, people are trying to smuggle oil to us. If we pull all the troops out, someone will control the oil, and that someone will try to sell it to the largest economy on earth. We don't need to be there to guarantee our supply of oil. We only need to be there to make sure that Exxon gets to buy and sell the oil. It'll just be somebody else selling us the oil. And if you don't happen to own Exxon, doesn't affect you in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, it's and you know, that's even if you do own Exxon, it's kind of like, sorry, you invested in a criminal organization. So, when you lose out, I'm not going to feel sorry
stocks.
For you.
I just mean, if you are not the sole proprietor of Exxon, if you have Exxon stocks, just buy some other stocks. I mean, you don't build a company. Who cares?
Yeah. I think that's actually an interesting point, because there's, I talk about, defaulting on the national debt and how that's a great idea. And people always come to me and say, well, what about all the people who bought, they bought bonds from the government? Well, so what? I mean, you buy bonds from any other corporation. And, first of all, government regulations make you like sign all these waivers and everything, acknowledging that everything you're buying is a huge risk. But for some reason, when you buy it from the government, you don't need to do that. It's just like, ooh, it's the holy bond that's guaranteed. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it's like if you buy a bond, and a bond is supposed to be more more guaranteed, I guess, than a stock. If you buy it from a company that fails, you still lose, even though it's more solid than a stock. And the same thing goes with government. Like, if you're the reason you're buying a bond is because they don't have the money. They're selling you a bond to raise money.
Right. Yeah.
And if they don't have money, like, how are they going to get the money to pay you back? It's a Ponzi scheme of some degree, because they don't even, you know, they don't do anything that generates revenue. They don't create a product. They don't produce.
Yeah. I mean, they're all you're basically, when you buy a bond, you assume that the government will have the ability to steal that money from someone else.
Exactly.
And in a moral sense, I agree with you. In a moral sense, I agree that that defaulting on the national debt is perfectly fine, morally speaking. But there's also very, you know, if I can do something in a painless way or a painful way, I prefer the painless way.
Sure.
It's how I look at violence, for example. I always believe that the right amount of violence is whatever the least amount of violence there is. If I'm out in an alley and some, you know, like tiny little, like 12-year-old kid starts trying to pick a fight with me, even though I'm confident that I would win, I'm still going to run away, because I would prefer to run, even though it's, like, you know, not tough and manly, than to engage in unnecessary violence.
Sure.
And the same with this. I agree that we could just that default national debt right away and have, but it would create, in my opinion, an unnecessary level of chaos that can actually be avoided much more simply to the same result in about the same amount of time. And so what I've been arguing in favor of, and what I will be using every ability that I can to do, is to erase certain laws, very specific laws. The first of those laws that has to go is the legal tender laws. Those are the laws that say you have to use dollar bills, that you can't use gold or copper or whatever you want as currency. And so the first thing that I'm going to say is get rid of all those laws. Make it easy to shift away from dollars. Then I'm going to get rid of all restrictions on cryptocurrency. Those aren't currencies created by the United States government. The United States government has no business in them at all. All taxes on those, any restriction on their use of any kind, I'm going to shut down. I'm also going to be using our trade leverage in ways to encourage that. For example, if there are countries that are using their power to try to shut down cryptocurrency, I'm not going to create trade sanctions because I don't believe in that. But I am also going to give every kind of favoritism I possibly can to their rivals, because I do believe that cryptocurrency is an important thing that we need to use whatever we can to spread that kind of freedom of currency. With those huge things there, with people using gold and copper and Bitcoin and Dash and Monero and everything like that, we can just phase out government money entirely. We can do it brutally, but we can also phase it out. I don't think it'll take that long. And I think it'll be nice, it'll be peaceful, and it'll be an orderly dissolution of that U.S. Dollar-based economy.
Well, I think you're right, and it's not a bad plan. But I don't think so, because so many other countries are basing their currencies on the U.S. dollar. I think that's still going to create. It's at some point it's probably going to create hyperinflation on the dollar, just because everybody's getting rid of it. And I think you still might face some of those challenges, but hey, at the same time, if there's hyperinflation, you can pay off your debt pretty easily.
That's also true. But I mean, really, this to me is just shifting from one system to another system.
Yeah.
You know, I've shifted in my business from one system to another system many times. That's the glory of private sector innovation. The United States has shifted from one system to other systems many, many times. Other countries have done that. We have, as individuals, have done that. We have the resilience to do it. And so I don't view this as something that's going to have to be very disruptive. I view it as just, it's going to be as disruptive as it was when one company goes out of business while another company becomes very successful. Some people are going to lose some money. Some people are going to gain some money. But overall, opportunity and innovation is going to increase, and that always increases jobs.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that, you know, people are going to wake up to eventually. Like, I think, you know, in some parts of the world, people know their governments are unstable and they're possibly going to fail. A lot of people have, you know, young countries. And for some reason in the U.S., we think we're completely immune to that. And the government's just going to be around forever. That could never happen in the U.S. So it's going to be interesting. And you know, I think a lot of people are going to face that harsh reality. And, you know, they've been trying to kick the can down the road long enough, but it's the road is coming to an end.
Sure. Although I just don't really see it as a harsh reality. When I think of my day to day, when most people think of their day to day, who they interact with, And they realize that most of their positive interactions are just not with the government. Most of their positive interactions are actually made slightly worse because of the government. And most of their negative interactions are either done with the government or heavily enhanced by the government. The shifting over from a public sector currency, which is as mismanaged as government schools are, it's not a well-managed currency. It's constantly inflating. What's good about that? It perpetually loses value. Why is that good? The shift away from something that's just not good to something that is better, I think, is going to be an improvement. I think that just as if everybody left government schools tomorrow, it might be weird for government school administrators. Yeah, it's going to be really bad for them, but it's going to be really good for everyone else. And that's the type of change that I'm seeing. There are going to be some people who are affected negatively, but the overall positivity is going to be so humongous that I more see it as almost a celebration, explosion of opportunity, more jobs, more innovation, more of everything that makes America great, and a reduction of government incompetence in the most important part of the economy, which is the money supply.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. So it's a transition we do need. I mean, you're right. We need to get off of the dollar. We need to get off of any type of printed fiat system where there's, you know, basically some central system that can at will devalue mm-hmm. it and give themselves more of it.
And has a history of doing it too, right? Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said for reputation. You know, if there's a private company that had fiat money, but had a centuries of reputation of never devaluing it, that's one thing.
Right.
But we have something that has a second to second, day to day, month to month reputation for decades of devaluing it. It's not like right. it's not like libertarian paranoia. Oh my God, they're going to devalue. They constantly devalue the currency. Oh, that's what they do on purpose. It's well known.
Yeah, it's what do they say? A healthy inflation rate is 3%. That's normal. Cool.
And they have that right. I mean, I want to put the government in competition with the private sector. And I'll say to people, listen, if you want your money to lose value constantly, here, go buy some government money. And if you don't, I'm going to make the other options as easy as I possibly can. And as president, there's a lot that I can do to make that transition a lot easier. One thing, of course, is the campaign itself. I wish the Gary Johnson campaign had talked constantly about cryptocurrency, because those network effects would have helped grow many competing cryptocurrencies, or talked about homeschooling, or talked about anything, because a campaign itself, even if you don't win, can actually lead to the things that change America. There are things like opting out of government schools, opting into cryptocurrencies, refusing to enlist in the military, engaging in jury nullification. These are things that we can all do without anyone getting elected to anything if we just use the campaign to spread the ideas. And I'm saying that's what you can get from losing a well-run campaign. Winning, though, the sky is the limit if we win.
Absolutely. And that's you know, that's another thing that you bring up, jury nullification, where mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about things where it's almost an act of, I don't want to say civil disobedience. Arguably it is, but it's government disobedience. You're disobeying, like when you engage in jury nullification, mm-hmm. you're disobeying the government, but you're obeying the law. You're doing what's lawfully your right to do.
Yeah.
And you're just telling the government, hey, screw off. We know like the orders you gave me are wrong. And I think the same thing, I know sheriffs can do this, and I don't hear it enough from candidates who are running from sheriff, but the sheriff is kind of like the king of the executive branch within the county. Mm-hmm. The sheriff has so much power. The sheriff can say, I'm not going to arrest these people for these yep. things. And it's an act of defiance against the government, but it's really like, it's not unlawful. It's not illegal. Mm-hmm. And you're acting in favor of what's the really the best interest for the people. So
that's why sheriff is an elected position. And there have been a few libertarians that have said that. They've said, if I get elected and somebody orders me to arrest somebody for some non-crime, I just won't do it. And that's powerful. You know, the idea of jury nullification, it's not a new idea in America. It's how we have freedom of press in the America. The Zanger trial they admitted, the Lord basically said, yes, he did this, that he broke this law, but the law itself is wrong. And the reason that we have a jury rather than, for example, like a tribunal of forensics experts is because that jury is there not to just judge whether or not you follow the law, but to judge the law itself. That's why a jury of your peers is so important. You know, I know a lot of anarcho-capitalists like myself, you know, they kind of frown on the Constitution, and I get where they're coming from. But when I read some of those early writings of some of the people that revolted against their own government, I find it very inspiring. And to me, that's one of the great traditions of America. Jury nullification is a great tradition. It's a great real American tradition that's been there since almost since before the Constitution. It's been a fundamental part of the DNA of this country. And I want to see that become a major part of what we do.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking, so you know, I'm unofficially running against you. And one thing that I've kind of realized with, you know, from my perspective, that is something that's really, that I see as really important, because of course I'm the taxationist theft guy, is, you know, a really great act of disobedience against the government would be for people to stop paying taxes. And what I see with that power of pardon is, you know, in the same way, removing that fear of people to disobey the government, knowing that they're not going to be punished for it. And so like we have, there's a lawyer is not allowed to, you know, let's say that's your defense strategy, right? You got caught smoking pot. The lawyer's there and says, hey, even though the government tells you, you have to say he's guilty, you can just say not guilty because you don't think it's a crime. And then that lawyer can be fined and charged with contempt of court. But if that lawyer knows that someone's got his back, there's a president that's going to say, hey, every day we're going to issue pardons against anyone who instructs a jury that nullification is a lawful, valid thing, then we're going to start to see more people act in disobedience because they know that, you know, yes, there might be some guys here at the local level that are going to try to fight me on it, but there's someone in government who's got their back, who's going to make sure that a lot of these people who are, you know, creating this resistance for government are not going to be punished for it. I think that's really powerful.
And that's very key. And I don't know if I mentioned this in my list at the top or if it skipped my mind, but one of the things on my list is tax evasion. I do not believe that tax evasion is a crime. I believe that theft is a crime and that trying to avoid being robbed is A, your natural right, and B, just kind of common sense. So I don't know if I remember to mention at the top, but that is absolutely on that list. If a lawyer is talking about jury nullification, one of the greatest traditions in America, the tradition that gave us freedom of the press, one of our most important traditions in America. If a lawyer is talking about this fundamental natural right, this thing that's part of the American tradition, and gets you know, fined for contempt of court or locked up for contempt of court, I'll be pardoning him. Before they get him to a cell, he'll already have a presidential pardon.
You didn't mention the part about the tax evasion, but yeah, it's you just like put this funny like comic in my head of like some guy, he's walking down an alley and some mugger comes up and says, give me your wallet. And he says, no. And he turns around and run. And then there's a cop and he says, you were running from the guy that was trying to get your wallet. I'm sorry, I have to arrest you. I mean, that's really what it is. Like, you know, nobody evades taxes because they're like, ooh, I'm going to rip off the government. No, they do it because they're like, this is my money. Why am I getting robbed?
Exactly. And there are cultural changes that need to happen. And some of them have started happening. Now, as I've mentioned before, I don't support violence. I don't support property damage. I know there's a lot of folks in the anarchist left, you know, Antifa and stuff like that, that disagree with me on that. And we respectfully disagree. A lot of those people are friends of mine. A lot of those people I've talked with deeply about politics. It's just an area where we disagree. But there are sometimes even where I'm on the fence myself. I'll admit them on that I'm on the fence. Not too long ago, up here in Maryland, they put up the speeding cameras, which, as we know, are just theft cameras. They're just theft plus trying to make you feel guilty while they're robbing you.
Right.
And somebody shot it, just shot the camera. And the Washington Post did their due diligence by like talking about how it was so terrible and how they really hope they catch the guy. I read the comments. It was something beautiful. Everyone was saying, yeah, I hope they do catch the guy so I can buy him a beer. And those are the type of things, those are the type of responses that I want to see. Now, I think we can do better than just, shooting property. I think there are better ways to do it. But the fact that the emotions are turning against the government, to me, is a glorious thing. Now we need to use that in more damaging ways to the government. If you want to help stop the government, the number one thing you can be doing right now is things that have nothing to do with changing laws. It's jury nullification. It's taking your kids out of government schools using homeschool. It's doing everything you can to either use cryptocurrency yourself or encourage others to do it. It's refusing to enlist in the armed services. Because here's the fact. If you don't enlist, they can't have their war. They can't have their war all by themselves. They need you to go along with it. So if you say, if you boldly and heroically and proudly say, I will not enlist to join and serve in an immoral non-war that goes on forever, if you say that, you're hamstringing that government. And those are the things that we can do as individuals. It doesn't require any kind of change in law of any kind.
Absolutely. And I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, because it's, we used to have a draft, and mm-hmm. now it seems like I've gone to the movie theaters and like in the previews, they have these ads for the army. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, it all starts adding up, right? They turn the military into like some like amazing experience that like, oh, you didn't get into college, you should go on this amazing experience. You're gonna get free trips around the world. You're gonna get to play with like all this huge military equipment, and they make it sound exciting. And they show it like right before you're gonna see a James Bond movie, right? So you're like, oh yeah, this is so awesome. I can actually be in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like they've transitioned into that because they know. Like, people used to be pissed off when there was a draft. They used to be like, oh, I don't want any part in that. I don't want to risk my life. I don't know what we're, like, they had to like really convince everyone that we were being invaded and all this other nonsense.
But when they try to convince America that we were being invaded by like 15 Vietnamese farmers, I mean, to believe that, you need to be just a very spectacular kind of dumb. And I mean, it's even more interesting that now the NSA has declassified the fact that the Gulf of Tonkin events, that was their flimsy excuse. I mean, such a stupid excuse to get into war. Somebody blows up one ship and you just like, lose so many lives and so much money. Who cares? That's an insane way to react. Why can't America learn from great men like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Henry David Thoreau that, yeah, you don't have to massively physically overreact to every single thing because you end up with something worse? But it turned out that flimsy, silly, stupid excuse, as dumb as it was, never even happened. It was a flimsy excuse that was also false. And that's the kind of stuff that really shows what type of people we're dealing with. But honestly, I love the fact that they're now going to use advertising and whatnot. Because they've shown us what their tools are. They've said, we're going to go for cultural change. That's cool. You can go for cultural change. You know who else can go for cultural change? Me. You know who else? All these other people. And if we stop playing along with their silly rules, if we stop, pretending that everyone who enlists in the military is some kind of hero when it just doesn't make any sense, if we stop playing that stupid game, if we have the courage not to defy the law, not to burn draft cards, not to run off to Canada, but to just say, no, it is wrong to join this military at this time. It is heroic to refuse to enlist. If we can say that with courage, we're going to undo their methods. That's their weapon. We have the same weapon. Their weapon's culture. So is ours. They don't have more cultural control than the American people do. They just have more force. They've actually put themselves on our turf. This is now a home game for us where we can actually defeat them.
Wow, that's a pretty awesome way to look at it.
I hope so. I mean, one of the things that I've been talking about a lot in terms of the military is not just on the individual level, but the strategic level. Sometimes it's okay to say, mission accomplished. We did what we were trying to do. Now we're done. The current stuff going on in the Middle East, it was a stupid way to go after one person. It was an insane way to send that much infantry after one guy. But despite their best attempt to mess it up, it worked. Okay, fine, it worked. Good, mission accomplished, come home. You did it, come home. And that's my view of NATO. The goal of NATO was to win the Cold War. It did. Thank you. Congratulations. You won. Now let's end it. We don't need it anymore. It did its task. It's over. It's finished. And today, NATO has become almost the opposite. It used to be there to protect capitalism from communism. Now it's protecting socialism from communism. It's protecting socialist Europe, supposedly, from communist Russia. I don't really know what the difference between socialism and communism is anymore, because I can't really see that the taxes are significantly higher in communist Russia than they are in Soviet and socialist France. I can't see that the restrictions are so much greater. You're dealing with essentially the same thing in two different places. And so it's time for us to shut it down. If socialist Europe wants to defend itself, it's more than welcome to do that without American tax money helping out.
So I want to get your opinion on this.
Sure.
Because you mentioned that we went in with the purpose of getting Osama, and that was like, and it was a terrible way to do it, and it took way too long, but we did it, and we should declare it done. Do you really think that that's why we were there, or like? Because I personally think that that was the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the excuse to get in there, because you know, like you said, once he's dead, they'd say, okay, we're done. But now it's like they're still there.
They're still there, right?
It's all these other side programs that they've got going. I mean, I know they say, oh, we're still fighting terrorism, but yeah, those are the same terrorists that you funded during this whole thing.
That's true. I mean, I've talked about winning the war on terror, and I do believe that it can be won. I do believe that I can be the person to help win it. I do believe that it requires a different mindset. Defeating terrorism is not going to come from this. You're right. What they're doing right now is just a way to funnel American tax dollars to American defense contractors. American defense contractors have become parasites. We need to stop funneling money to them. We need to shut down all those foreign operations, bring all those troops home, shut down all those foreign military bases. Everyone, it's time to come home. You did the job. As idiotic as the original plan, as stupid as the strategy was, it was achieved. It's time to come home. But I also believe we can win this war, because, you know, when people, a lot of times Americans don't understand the way that terrorism really works on the ground level. And I would like, if you don't mind, to take just a brief opportunity to actually describe what it's like. Here's how terrorism works. You have people, young men who are poor, who have no opportunity, who are frustrated. You have basically a minor league cult leader that comes and says, you want to join us? See, we're going to fight these guys that are drone bombing this place. We're going to fight those guys in that base. And the young guys, it's basically he's joining a gang. You know, people act as if these are these like massive military. They're not any massive military breakthrough things. It's basically a cult plus a gang. It's minor league stuff. And we're losing because we're helping them win. In order to defeat them, we need to do two things. The things that fund, that allow terrorism to happen are it's really just two things. There's only two things required for terrorism. And you take away those two things, terrorism cannot succeed. The first is poverty. If people have other options, any other option, if your choice is to work at Starbucks versus blowing yourself up, you're going to say, yeah, the Starbucks thing, that sounds kind of cool. So one is any other options. And that means we need to lift all trade sanctions. We need to end those trade sanctions, because those trade sanctions create poverty. And that poverty, just like, you know, people are like, poverty creates crime. Yeah, of course it creates crime. If you have no other opportunities, of course you're going to do crime. Poverty also creates terrorism. Terrorism is crime. Terrorism is not military. We're not dealing with, like, you know, George Washington or Scipio or Alexander the Great here. This is crime we're dealing with. So the first thing is poverty. And for that, we have to get rid of all trade sanctions, complete open trade. The second thing that it requires is the existence of an enemy. If they need a point, if they can point to drones, if they can point to bases, they can say, yeah, it's that guy's fault. It's their fault that you're unhappy. The way to end that is to just stop being the enemy, to leave. Will they find some other enemies? Yeah, probably. They can blow up those enemies. That's not us. Our job isn't to protect everyone from everyone. It's just to protect ourselves. And so by bringing all the troops home, I imagine those young kids in the Middle East, young men in the Middle East, looking at a droneless sky, seeing the empty military bases that have turned into shopping malls and office centers where they can have jobs and opportunities. I imagine people like that with all these great opportunities, no reason for hatred of the West, somebody coming up to them and saying, hey, do you want to be a suicide bomber against America? And them just laughing. Be like, why would I want to do that? That doesn't make any sense. The way that we today might laugh if someone says, hey, you want to be a suicide bomber against Japan? And you would say, no, all this cool stuff comes from Japan. I like Japan. What are you talking about? And that's how to defeat terrorism. This is a war of ideology. This is a war of poverty. We have better ideas. We have a bigger economy. We can end terrorism by actually ending it instead of fueling it. Current military policy is literally fueling terrorism.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's really a great way to look at it. And you know, we see, I mean, so I'm spending a lot of time down in Mexico right now, and mm-hmm. I see, like, you know, because everyone's always fighting over the border, and I see the same thing with the, because it's like they're right next to each other, mm-hmm. and for some reason it's like over here you have all this wealth, and 100 feet in the other direction you have all this poverty, and it's like why is that? Like, mm-hmm. it's not because these people are a certain way. It's because a lot of them actually live on the other side and they have some of that wealth. It's because of this border and the restrictions on the trade and everything that they have. And like you said, that creates poverty, and then that poverty creates crime. And then especially mm-hmm. when you have this drug war that you're like, everyone's so afraid of like all this crime in Mexico. If you remove, like, so if you look at the murder statistics for Mexico and you remove all the drug dealers and gang members who mm-hmm. were murdered, like the crime stats are really actually not that high.
Yeah.
It's lower than a lot of American cities.
And that's really key. And so one of the nice benefits of, you know, my way of ending the drug war, which is to pardon everybody or somebody else's way to end the drug war, is that you take the crime out of it. You want to sell drugs? Fine. I don't think that there's anything great about drugs. If I'm president, I'll probably talk about it. I know that a lot of people in libertarian circles want to believe that drugs are good. That's cool. You're welcome to that opinion. I don't share it. If I'm president, I will probably be encouraging people to not use drugs in a, like, not in a hostile way, but I'll just say, here's why I don't use drugs. Here's why I think it's benefited me. It might be something for you to consider. I mean, I think I try to be polite about it, but that doesn't mean that I think it's good to actually use force, because the force creates the crime. And ending that drug war, or nullifying the drug war, you don't have to wait for me. We can all do it right now. We can nullify that drug war with the power of the jury, is going to nullify all that crime that goes with it. That's the power that we have. It's the power we have right now. We just need to remind people that they have that power.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we've covered a lot. Are there any other key issues that you have? I guess we could talk about the Mexican border. What's your
sure.
position on that?
My view on borders has always been open borders, no welfare. And I really do believe that if we can have less welfare than any country on earth, I believe that should be America's goal, to have the worst welfare in the world. We have the least welfare of any place. And that means if you're looking for welfare, you'll go anywhere else. But if you're looking for opportunity, if you're looking to innovate, if you're looking to start a business, come on over. Today, it is nearly impossible for a foreign national just to start a business in America. It's starting a business. I mean, that's what creates jobs. We're saying to people in other countries, hey, do you want to come over here and create jobs? And they're like, sure, I would love to. And we're like, well, too bad. I want to go and have a startup in America visa. That's a thing that just doesn't exist. To make matters worse, the people who are most likely to start up those businesses, skilled labor. We have hard caps on skilled labor. The crime rate among this group is basically zero. And we are restricting the number of highly skilled workers who can come to America, who can innovate, who can create jobs, who will spend their money in America at restaurants and private schools and clothing stores and everywhere. We're keeping them out. This policy doesn't make sense. But that said, you never know if that person who has no degree of any kind might be that great innovator. And we've seen that in America. So many great innovators are college dropouts. It's one of the reasons that I've often encouraged people to consider every option besides college first.
Yeah.
So the way I look at it is this: get rid of all the welfare, government schools, Medicare, Medicaid, all that kind of stuff. Get rid of it, and then open the borders as wide as we can. Bring in all the innovators and job creators. And we're going to see economic growth, jobs in America, innovation in America, like nothing has ever been seen before in the history of the world.
Nice. So I can already imagine your answer to some of this, but But I want to ask anyway. What about some of the things like federal land where they own? I think it's the federal government that owns most of the, like, 80% or 70% of the land on the West Coast, or west of the Mississippi. What would you do with all that?
To me, that actually is tied to another problem, which is Social Security. I believe that the solution to Social Security is to pay back to people whatever they paid in and then shut it down. Pay back to people. If you paid in for 1 year, you're going to get that 1 year back, and then we shut it down. Where does that money come from? You just answered it for me. Selling off that federal land, sell all of it. And let's use that to actually shut down, to pay off Social Security and shut the program down. But I would like to see things actually go further in that area. One of the major things that I've talked about is ending all foreign aid so that countries are forced to sell off sovereign territory. And what that means, when you sell sovereign territory, you're basically selling essentially a new country. You're selling a country either to an existing country or to private investors. And what I would love to see around every current country, I want to see 50, 100 small startup countries, like a Hong Kong type model, everywhere. And I wouldn't mind seeing a few Hong Kongs in the United States. I would love to see private countries competing with public countries so that people have options. And maybe I'm wrong. And maybe public countries can do better than private countries. But I strongly doubt it. And we'll be able to find out by letting them openly compete.
So what would, this is an interesting concept I haven't really heard before, but what would a private country look like? The first thing that pops into my head is something like Disneyland, where they own a pretty, like, it's almost like a city, but it's all private property. But of course they don't have housing and, you know, they have jobs and businesses, but
they do. I mean, they have housing, they have their own little city. The main difference is, though, that Disney, I think they have their own town. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But the difference is that Disney can't set the income tax level. It can't set laws. It can't make its own rules. What I want to see is many, 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 many small countries making their own laws and seeing what works. And listen, I'm not saying that every one of those countries is going to be super libertarian. There might be some countries with very strict laws, maybe something maybe more like an Amish type country. There might be other countries that have total freedom. And the great thing over there is you get what we already have in restaurants. You have choice. The greatest power in America is not the power of your voice, the power of your vote. It's the power to leave a restaurant you don't like, to not buy an article of clothing or a computer that you don't like. And I would love to see America look like that, where there's so many different countries in what we call the United States today, that if you want a country that meets these specific specifications, there's one right waiting there right for you. Just as today, if you want to go to a restaurant that serves the kind of food that they serve in all places, Thailand. I mean, if you think about it, that's historically an insane request. Someone says, like, hey, I want to go to a place that serves the kind of food that they serve totally around the earth. Can we go do that? I mean, that's an insane request, but we can do that today. And that's the magic of it. If somebody says, hey, I want to go to a place that has kind of a mixture of, like, food from Thailand and, you know, food from South America, again, a kind of a ridiculous request. That's the kind of request that in the olden days, even kings wouldn't make a request that crazy, because a king would say, well, that's an insane request to make of a chef. I'm not going to do that. But today, just normal people do. Be like, yeah, let's go get that. And imagine if we could do that with countries. We're not far away. To make this happen outside of the United States, we just need to get rid of one thing. It's the most politically unpopular thing in the entire budget, and that's foreign aid. We get rid of foreign aid, I promise you countries will sell sovereign territory. But we can also have that happen in America. And I would love to see that happen in America. If not America, just somewhere close to America, in South America, in the Caribbean, hell, in Europe, Africa, Asia, South America, somewhere. I would love to see it happen.
That's pretty interesting. I haven't heard anything like that before. Cool. But except of course maybe for micronations. But I think those, depending on where they are, they've had some trouble with the bigger nations next to them. trying to
people don't
them.
Like competition. What can we say?
Right. So that's all pretty interesting. Before we wrap this up, is there anything, are you looking for anything specifically right now, in terms of volunteers or donations, or is there anywhere that anyone can go to, get more information on your campaign, websites, Facebook pages?
Absolutely. And I want to tell everyone this. First of all, I know that right now, most people believe that it is not possible for a libertarian to win the nomination, to win the presidency, and that this whole thing just is a fool's errand. And I'm going to tell you right now that in my campaign, if we lose, we're going to change culture. If we win, we're going to change policy. But either way, my campaign, if I have your help, we're going to change America. No matter whether we win or lose, we will change America. But for that, I do need some help. It's not something that I can do all by myself. And if you have time, if you're willing to volunteer, please go to votevora.com and sign up to volunteer. If you don't have time, but you do have money, let me tell you exactly what I'm going to do with your money. Because I know people worry, like, what are these campaigns going to do? It's been a concern with libertarian campaigns in the past. I'm going to tell you right now what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be using that money to push heavy advertising outreach of big, bold libertarian ideas. Even my advertising is not going to be advertising that just says, please vote for me, here's why I'm harmless. Even my advertising is going to be pushing forward major libertarian ideas, abolishing government schools, ending the income tax. So you send me a dollar, that's going to send out maybe 10 brochures. That's going to send out 10 brochures with those ideas, and maybe one of those is going to inspire somebody to really get these libertarian ideas. You give me $100, that could be 1,000 brochures going out, and I bet it's going to be more than just one person who's going to see those and say, wow, I've been waiting for this ideology my whole life. Let me spread this message. And we will get those ideas out there. If you are willing to do either of those things, or you just want to learn more about my campaign before you invest your time or money, please go to votevora.com. And my last name is spelled V as in Victor, O-H-R-A.
Awesome. And yeah, I just want to reiterate what you just said, that there are a lot of people who see the mess. They're going to see the message and say, I've been waiting for that. It's so absolutely true. Like when I walk around with this hat on, that says taxation is theft, people come to me and say, that's awesome. And it starts a conversation. And what I've realized is there are so many people who already think that, and they're just afraid to say anything about it because they think the big bad IRS is going to come around and, and, you know, just take everything from them just for speaking up and saying this is wrong. So I think that's really awesome, and pushing those bold ideas is definitely the way to go to you know, let people know that they're not alone thinking that maybe we should just change the whole thing and get rid of all of it.
Absolutely. And I don't have it on right now because I put on this suit and I had to take it off to get my cufflinks on. But I've been wearing that taxation of theft bracelet. I love it. There's so many people who see it and they're like, oh, thank God somebody finally said it. And I'm telling you, we make this campaign explode. We're going to get those messages out there far past anything that I could do just all by myself. So I really would appreciate any kind of help or support.
Awesome. That sounds great. All right. Well, it was great talking with you, and we'll definitely have you on again and follow up.
Absolutely. Appreciate
that. See how the campaign goes. And your election for U.S. Senate is in November, right?
Yep.
Okay. So if you're in Maryland, check out Arvin on your U.S. Senate ballot in November, and we'll hear some more from him about president in 2020. That's going to be pretty awesome.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.
Anytime. Taxation is theft. I'll see you later.